Hi, Bruce Clark once again. We're ready to go with week number 3. This week, we're going to look at ancient Egypt. Soon after they appear in Sumer, the first signs of civilization appear in Egypt. If the Egyptians learned from Sumer, and it seems likely that they did, we don't know how or what or when or to what extent. Much more of the explanation is supplied, as in southern Mesopotamia, by the Seni. Prehistoric climate changes had gradually dried up the most of Egypt outside of the Nile Valley itself, yet that narrow strip of fertile land was enough. Mud washed down from the interior highlands and deposited there enough agricultural area to make farming fairly easy. For about 1,800 miles, the river flowed perhaps as little as a few hundred yards wide and as much as 5 or 6 miles wide. This whole area became a long, straggling oasis surrounded by desert and rock. It was importantly different than ancient Mesopotamia as the setting for the new stage of human development. The Egyptians needed no such reclamation works as the Sumerians had. The Nile was a lot friendlier than the Tigris and the Euphrates. But like them, it flooded every year. It just did so predictably. Its floods were not sudden, surprising disasters. They occurred so regularly that the entire agricultural year was patterned around them. The Nile was a huge clock regulating the life of ancient Egyptians in a rhythm unvaried from year to year. At about 3300 BC, substantial numbers of people already lived along some 1,000 miles of the river. From the lower Nile in the villages and hamlets, not separated by one another so much, up to the very end of the Nile. These Egyptians first seemed to have thought of themselves as members of clans rather than settled communities. Cities really didn't develop along the river until 1,000 years had passed, perhaps because there were no powerful neighbors to threaten the farmers and encourage them to live in towns for their own protection. But about these early days, it is difficult to know much because the Nile destroyed the evidence each year, either washing it away to the delta or burying it deep in the banks of soil, which slowly rose above the high water mark as the centuries passed. We know that these early Egyptians knew how to make papyrus boats, to work with hard stone, to hammer copper into articles for daily use. Somewhere about the middle of the 4th millennium, there are signs of contact with other areas, notably Mesopotamia. There is a sudden sense of rapid crystallization. Information rapidly becomes much more abundant about early civilized Egypt than about anywhere else at so early a date. Egyptians had, from almost the start, a form of writing called hieroglyphic. It was in origin pictograph, that is, consisting of little pictures which stood for the names of things. With time, they came to stand for sounds. Because it was always harder to write hieroglyphic, never spread as did cuneiform, though it had just as long a life. The last known example of hieroglyphic did not appear until about 400 A.D. Thereafter, as mastery of writing, it was lost. So it became unintelligible. Then at the beginning of the 19th century, the Rosetta Stone was brought back to France from Egypt. It was inscribed in Greek and the latter Demotic Egyptian as well as in hieroglyphic. And this made translation possible. It opened the way to understanding ancient Egypt as it had never before been understood because the large number of inscriptions on tombs and monuments and papyrus still survived. From these hieroglyphics, there emerged a narrative. Egypt was, by 3000 BC, already organized into two kingdoms, the northern and the southern, lower and upper Egypt. Soon, the records say a king from the south, called Menes, conquered the north and established a dynasty which lasted until about 2900 BC, ruling from Memphis and lower Egypt. This was a realm approximately 1,600 miles long, a much bigger area than any other contemporary state, but its government, is rather difficult to say, but it is an impressive achievement to have established even a claim to rule such a large area. More striking still, this began nearly 2,000 years, during which Egypt was usually under one ruler, one religious system, and one pattern of government and society, while no important influences intruded from the outside. Oh, sure, there were ups and downs. The state was sometimes strong and prosperous, and other times was quite weak and poor. Nonetheless, this is still astonishing continuity, and it made possible great achievements whose physical remains would long fascinate mankind as its greatest visible inheritance from antiquity. The historical records enable scholars to talk about ancient Egypt as a series of dynasties in three major divisions in time. The first of them, termed the Old Kingdom, began about 2650 and lasted until 2150 BC. There followed a century or so of upheaval before the Middle Kingdom then began about 2050. This lasted until approximately 1800 BC when another disturbed period began, and that ended about 1550 BC when we find the beginning of the New Kingdom. Into this tripartite scheme are then fitted two intermediate periods and the dates of the dynasties. It can be conveniently closed off at the beginning of the first millennium BC when the Egyptians' greatest achievements were behind them. Although there was to be an independent Egypt under its own rulers until approximately 30 BC when it came to an end with the suicide of the legendary queen, Cleopatra. The state itself was the embodiment of Egyptian civilization. It was centered first at Memphis, the capital of the Old Kingdom. Later, under the New Kingdom, the capital became Thebes. These two places were great religious centers and palace complexes. They were not really cities with lives apart from government. Partly, this was because Egypt's kings had not emerged as the big guys in the city-state community, which originally deputed them to act for it. They were themselves to be gods. At an early stage, Egyptian monarchs already had an impressive authority, as their huge images on the early monuments show. They inherited it ultimately from prehistoric kings who had a special sanctity because of their power to ensure prosperity through successful agriculture. They were believed to control the annual rise and fall of the Nile, life itself no less, to the various communities. The first rituals of Egyptian kingship, which are known to us, are concerned with fertility, irrigation, and land reclamation. The earliest representations of Menes shows him excavating a canal. Under the Old Kingdom, the idea appears that the king, or the pharaoh, was the absolute lord, and soon he was venerated as a god. Justice is what pharaoh loves, evil what pharaoh hates. He is divinely omnipotent, and so needs no code of law to guide him. Later, under the New Kingdom, the pharaohs were to be depicted with the heroic stature and statures of great warriors. They are shown in their chariots, mighty men of war, trampling down their enemies and confidently slaughtering beasts of prey. But the Egyptian kingship remains sacred and awesome. He is a god whose dealings one lives, the father and mother of all men, alone by himself, without equal, wrote an Egyptian civil servant of the pharaoh as late as about 1500 B.C. By then, Egypt had an elaborate and impressive hierarchy of bureaucrats. Usually the most important came from the nobility. A few of the greatest were buried with pomp rivaling that of the pharaohs. Less eminent families provided thousands of scribes to staff and service the elaborate machines of governments. They were trained in a special school at Thebes, and their ethos can be sensed through texts which list the virtues needed to succeed as a scribe. Application to study, self-control, prudence, respect for superiors, scrupulous regard for sanctity of weights, measures, landed property, and legal forms. Most Egyptians, though, were peasants, providing labor for great public works, and the surplus upon which a noble class, the bureaucracy, and a great religious establishment could subsist. The land was rich enough and was increasingly improved by irrigation techniques, which were some of the earliest manifestations of the remarkable capacity to mobilize collective efforts, which Egyptian government long showed. Vegetables, barley, emmer were the main crops of the fields laid out along the irrigation canals. The diet they afforded was supplemented by poultry, fish, and game. Cattle were used for transaction and plowing at least as early as the Old Kingdom. With little change, this agriculture sustained Egypt into modern times. It also made public works in stone unsurpassed in their time. Houses and farm buildings were made of mud brick. They were not meant to outface eternity. The palaces, tombs, and memorials of the pharaohs were a different matter, social and administrative as architectural triumphs. Under the direction of a scribe, thousands of slaves and sometimes regiments of soldiers would be deployed to cut and manhandle into position huge pieces of stone, carefully dressed first with copper and then bronze tools, and often elaborately incised and painted. With only such assistance as was available from levers and sleds, there were, of course, no winches, pulleys, blocks, or tackles at that time, and by the use of colossal ramps built of earth, a succession of still startling buildings was produced. The most famous, of course, are the pyramids, which dominate the great complexes of buildings housing the king after death. Among those of the Third Dynasty at Sakwara, near Memphis, one of the step pyramids was the masterpiece of the first identified architect, Imhotep, chancellor to the king. He was later to be deified as a god of medicine as well as revered as an astronomer, priest, and sage. The beginning of the building in stone was attributed to him, and it is easy to believe that something so unprecedented as a 200-foot-high pyramid was seen as evidence of his godlike ability and power. During the Fourth Dynasty, though, still greater pyramids were completed at Giza. Cheops' pyramid was 20 years in the building, and great quantities of stone, between 5 and 6 million tons, were brought in from as far away as 500 miles. This colossal structure is perfectly orientated, and its sides, about 750 feet long, vary by less than 10 inches. Unsurprisingly, the pyramids later figured among the seven wonders of the world. Nor, of course, were they the only great monuments of Egypt. At other sites, there were great temples, palaces, and tombs, such as in the Valley of the Kings. These great public works explain why the Egyptians were later thought to have been great scientists. People could not believe that such building did not require the most refined mathematical and scientific knowledge. Yet, though Egyptians' surveying was highly skilled, and Egyptian civil servants were certainly accomplished civil engineers, only elementary mathematics was needed to build as they did. Competence in measuring and manipulation of certain formulae for calculating volumes and weights was sufficient, and this was as far as Egyptian mathematics ever went. The Egyptians did not rival Babylon in sciences. The inscriptions in which Egyptian astronomical observations were recorded commanded centuries of respect from astrologers, but their scientific value was low and their protective quality relatively short. Their one solid achievement was the calendar. The Egyptians established the solar year of 365 days, which they divided into 12 months, each of 3 weeks of 10 days. With 5 extra days at the end of the year, an arrangement, it may be remarked, revived in 1793 when the French revolutionaries sought to replace the Christian calendar with one more rational. The religious life of ancient Egypt also greatly struck foreigners, yet it remains something with which it is difficult to come to grips. An all-pervasive framework as much taken for granted as the circulatory system of the human body, rather than an independent structure such as what later came to be understood as a church. It was not consciously seen as a growing, lively force. It was rather one aspect of reality, a description of an unchanging cosmos. But this, too, may be a misleading way of putting it. We have to remember that concepts and distinctions which we take for granted did not exist for the ancient Egyptians. The boundary between religion and magic, for example, hardly mattered for them. Whatever religion in ancient Egypt meant, for almost the whole duration of their civilization, the ancient Egyptians show a remarkable consistent tendency to seek through it at a way of penetrating the variety of the flow of ordinary experience so as to reach a changeless world more easily understood through the life and the dead lived when the dead lived there. Perhaps the pulse of the Nile is to be detected here, too. Each year it swept away and made new, but its cycle was forever reoccurring, changeless, the embodiment of a cosmic rhythm. The supreme change threatening men was death, the worst expression of the decay and flux, which was their common experience. Egyptian religion seems from the start possessed with it. Its most familiar embodiments, after all, are the mummy and the grave goods from funeral chambers preserved in our museums. Under the Middle Kingdom, it came to be believed that all men, not just the king, could expect life in another world. Accordingly, through ritual and symbol, through preparation of the case he would have to put to his judge in the afterworld, the man might prepare for the afterlife with a reasonable confidence that he could achieve the changeless well-being offered by its principles. The Egyptian view of afterlife was unlike the gloomy version of the Mesopotamians. Men could be happy in it. The centuries-long struggle to assure that they would explain the obsessively elaborate care shown in preparing tombs and conducting the deceased to his eternal resting place. The Egyptian pantheon was huge. There were about 2,000 gods and several important cults, some originating in prehistoric animal deities. One, Horses, the falcon god, was also god of the dynasty. These animals underwent a slow but incomplete humanization. Artists stuck their animal heads on human bodies. Their relationships were rearranged in the fresh patterns as the pharaohs sought through the consolidation of their cults to achieve political ends. In this way, the cult of Horus was consolidated with that of the sun god, of whom the pharaoh came to be regarded as the incarnation. It was not the end of the story. Horus later underwent another transformation to appear as the offspring of Osiris, the central figure of a national cult, and his consort Isis. This goddess was creation and love, was probably the most ancient of all. Her origins go back to the pre-dynastic era. She was one development of an ubiquitous mother god of whom evidence survives from all over the Neolithic Near East. She was long to endure, her image, the infant Horus in her arms, surviving into Christian iconography of the Virgin Mary. Strange, but apparently true. Among the most celebrated variations of the doctrinal and speculative kind must be reckoned the attempt of the 14th century pharaoh to establish the cult of Aten, another manifestation of the sun. It has been seen as the first monolithic religion. The gods loom large in ancient Egypt art, but it contains much more besides. It was based on fundamental naturalism, which, however restrained by conventions of expression and gesture, gave it for two millennia as first a beautiful simplicity and later in a more decadent style an interior charm and approachability. It permitted a realistic portrait of scenes of everyday life. Rural themes of farming, fishing, and hunting were deployed. Craftsmen are shown at work on their products and scribes at their duties. For some 2,000 years, artists were able to work satisfying within the same classic tradition while borrowing from foreign influences, with a central strength and solidity which never wavers. It must have been one of the most impressive visual features of Egypt to a visitor in ancient times, What he saw was all of peace, the longest and strongest continual tradition in the whole history of civilized art. Some ancient Egyptian art has survived thanks to the invention as early as the first dynasty of papyrus, strips of reed pith, later crisscrossed and found together into a homogeneous sheet. This was the real contribution to the progress of mankind. It did more for communication than hieroglyph. Papyrus was cheaper than skin, from which parchment was made, and more convenient, though more perishable, than clay tablets or slates of stone. It was therefore to be the most general basis of correspondence and record in the Near East until well into the Christian era, when the invention of paper arrived from the Far East. It took its name, of course, from papyrus. Soon after the appearance of papyrus, writers began to paste sheets of it together into long rolls. Thus, the Egyptians invented the book, as well as the material on which it could first be written. A huge proportion of what we know of antiquity comes down to us on papyrus. The supposed prowess of her religion and magical practitioners and the spectacular embodiment of political achievement in art and architecture explains much of Egypt's continuing prestige. Yet, if her civilization is looked at comparatively, it seems neither very fertile nor very responsive. Stone architecture is the only major innovation for a long time after the coming of literacy. The Egyptians invented the column. Technology history suggests a people slow to adopt new skills, reluctant to innovate once the imaginative creative jump to civilization had been made. There is no definite evidence of the presence of a potter's wheel before the Old Kingdom. For all the skills of goldsmiths and coppersmiths, bronze making does not appear until well into the second millennium BC, and the lathe only much later still. The bow drill was almost the only tool for the multiplication and transmission of energy available to Egyptian craftsmen. So papyrus and the wheel were known under the first dynasty. Egypt had been in touch with Mesopotamia for getting on for 2,000 years before they adopted the well sweep, by then long in use to irrigate land in the other river valleys. Life for the Egyptian poor was hard, but not unremitting. The major burden must have been conscripted labor services. When these were not extracted by Pharaoh, then the peasant would have considerable leisure at those times when he wanted, while he waited for the flooding Nile to do its work for him. The agricultural base was rich enough, too, to sustain a complex and variegated society with a wide range of craftsmen. After their activities, and about their activities, we know more than of those of their Mesopotamian equivalents. Thanks to stone carvings and paintings, the great division of this society was between the educated, who could enter the state service, and all of the rest. Slavery was important, but it appears less fundamental an institution than many other places in the ancient Near East. Women in ancient Egypt certainly had their place. Tradition in later times remarked upon the accessibility of Egyptian women. It helped to give an impression of a society which gave themselves somewhat more independence and higher status than their sisters in other civilizations. Some weight must be given to an art which depicts court ladies clad in fine cottons and exquisite coiffures and jewels and wearing the carefully applied cosmetics which were common to many of the areas of Egypt, where Egyptian merchants, of course, sold them and the ladies gave them much attention. But we should not lead too strongly on this, but because even the pictorial impression of the way in which women of Egypt's ruling class were treated is important, and it is one of dignity and independence. The pharaohs and their consorts and other noble couples, as sometimes depicted with an intimacy of mood found nowhere else in art of the ancient Near East before the first millennia B.C., their suggestion of a real emotional equality can hardly be accidental. Beautiful and charming women who appear in many of the paintings and sculptures may reflect a certain political potential for their sex which was lacking elsewhere. The throne often in praxis descended through the female line. An heiress brought to her husband the right of succession. Hence, there was much anxiety about the marriage of princesses. Many royal marriages were of brother and sister, apparently without unsatisfactory genetic effects. Some pharaohs married their daughters, but perhaps to prevent anyone else marrying them rather than to ensure the continuity of divine blood. Some female consorts exercised important power, and one even occupied the throne, being willing to appear ritually bearded in men's clothing and taking the title of pharaoh. There is also femininity about the Egyptian pantheon, notably in the cult of Isis, which is, of course, very prominent. Literature and art stress a respect for the wife and mother, which goes beyond the confines of the circle of the notabilities. Love stories and scenes of family life seem to emphasize a very tender feeling towards the family, as well as times of relaxation and informality. Some women were even literate, and there is an Egyptian word for a female scribe. But there were, of course, not many occupations open to women outside of the home, except as a priestess. If they were well off, however, they could own property, and their legal rights seemed to be, in most respects, to have been akin to those of the Sumerian women. For all the records, it is difficult to keep in perspective Egypt's relations with the world outside or the ebb and flow of authority within the Nile Valley. There are huge tracts of time to account for when it is difficult to be sure exactly what was going on and what was important. For nearly 1,000 years at Menes, Egyptian history can be considered in virtual isolation. It was to be looked upon as a time of stability when pharaohs were impregnable. Yet, under the Old Kingdom, there has been detected a decentralization of authority, provincial officers showing increasing importance and independence. The pharaoh, too, still had to wear two crowns and was twice buried, once in Upper and once in Lower Egypt. That division was still real. Relations with neighbors were not remarkable, though a series of expeditions was mounted against the people of Palestine toward the end of the Old Kingdom. The first intermediate period, which followed, saw the position reverse, and Egypt was the invaded rather than the invader. No doubt weakness and division helped Asian invaders to establish themselves for a time in the valley of the Lower Nile. The Middle Kingdom was effectively inaugurated by a powerful king who reunified the kingdom from his capital at Thebes. For about a quarter millennium, about 2000 BC, Egypt enjoyed a period of recovery, and there was a new emphasis on order and social cohesion. The divine status of the pharaoh supplied subtle changes. Not only is he a god, it is emphasized that he is descended from gods and will be followed by gods. The eternal order will continue unshaken after bad times have made man doubt. It is certain, too, that there was expansion and material growth. Great reclamation work was achieved in the marshes of the Nile. Nubia, to the south, between the first and third cataracts, was conquered and its gold mines exploited. Egyptian settlements were founded even farther south in what was later to be a mysterious kingdom called Kush. Trade leaves more elaborate traces than ever before, and the copper mines of Sinai were now worked again. Yet the Middle Kingdom ended in political upheaval and dynastic competition. The second intermediate period of roughly 200 years was marked by another and far more dangerous incursion of foreigners, remembered as the Hyksos. Not much is known about them, but they were probably a Semitic people who used the military advantage of iron-fitted chariots to win overlordship in the Nile Delta. Seemingly, they took over Egyptian conventions and methods, even maintaining the existing bureaucrats at first. But this did not lead to assimilation, and under the 18th dynasty, they were evicted. This was the start of the new kingdom, which followed up victory in the years after 1570 BC by pursuing the Hyksos into their strongholds in southern Cana, and in the end occupying much of Syria and Palestine. The new kingdom, in its prime, was internationally well successful and left rich physical memorials. There was, under the 18th dynasty, almost a renaissance of arts, transformative military techniques by the adoption of Asiatic devices such as the chariot, and above all, a huge consolidation of royal authority. Interestingly enough, this was when the throne was for a time occupied by a woman, Hatshepsut. For a century or so, Egypt won further military glory. Hatshepsut, consort and successor, Ptolemy's third, carried the limits of the empire to the Euphrates. Monuments, according to the arrival of tribute and slaves or marriages with Asiatic princesses, testified to Egypt's preeminence. At home, the period is generally regarded as the peak of Egyptian artistic achievement, though foreign influences from places such as Crete can be discovered. Toward the end of the New Kingdom, signs of multiple foreign contacts begin to show also that the world outside Egypt had already changed in many ways. Even though Thutmose III had taken 17 years to subdue the Levant, and he had left unconquered a large empire ruled by the people called Mitanni, who dominated eastern Syria and northern Mesopotamia. Later, a Mitanni princess married a pharaoh, and the new kingdom came to rely on the friendship of her people to protect Egyptian interests in that area. Egypt was being forced out of the isolationist mode that had long protected her, but the Mitanni were under growing pressure to the north from the Hittites, one of the most important of the people whose ambitions and movements break up the world so that the Near East more and more as the second half of the second millennium BC, things went on changing. Egypt reached its peak of prestige and prosperity under Amenhotep III, approximately 410 to 375 BC. It was the greatest era of Thebes, and he was fittingly buried there in the largest tomb ever prepared for a king, though nothing of it now remains but the fragments of the huge statues the Greeks later called the Colossus of Memnon, a legendary hero that they supposed to be Ethiopian. His successor, Amenhotep IV, attempted a religious revolution. The substitution of a monotheistic cult of the sun god Aten for the ancient religion. To mark his seriousness, he changed his name to Akhmenon and founded a new city of Amara, 300 miles north of Thebes, where a temple with a roofless sanctuary open to the sun's rays was the center of the new creed. The opposition his religious revolution provoked helped to cripple him on other fronts. Meanwhile, Hittite pressure was telling on the Egyptian dependencies. Asenon could not save Mitanni. They lost all their lands west of the Euphrates to the Hittites in 1370. A civil war then preceded their kingdom's disappearance about 30 years later. The Egyptian imperial sphere was crumbling. Amenhotep IV had changed his name because he wished to erase the reminiscence of the cult of the old god Amun. His successor and son-in-law changed his name to Tutankhamun to register its restoration and overthrow the attempted religious reform. It may have been gratitude for that that led the magnificent burial in the Valley of the Kings, which is given Tutankhamun, after only a short and otherwise rather unremarkable reign. When he died, the new kingdom had 2 centuries of life ahead, but they were centuries of only occasionally interrupt and steadily accelerating decline. Later kings made efforts to recover lost ground and sometimes succeeded. The waves of conquest rolled back and forth over Palestine, and at one time a pharaoh took a Hittite princess as a bride, as his predecessors had taken princesses from other people. But there was yet more new enemies, and they were approaching rapidly. Even a Hittite alliance was no longer a safeguard. The Aegean was in uproar. The islands poured out their people altogether, and no land stood before them, say the Egyptian records. These sea peoples were eventually beaten off, but the struggle was hard. From about 1150 BC, the signs of internal disorganization are plentiful. One king, Ramses III, died as a result of a conspiracy in the harem. He was the last to achieve some measure of success in offsetting the swelling tide of disaster. We hear of strikes and economic troubles under his successors and sacrilegious looting of royal tombs at Thebes. The age of Egyptians' imperial power was, in fact, a thing of the past. So was that of the Hittites and of other empires at the end of the second millennium. The world, which was the setting of Egypt's glory, was itself passing away. Much of the explanation of Egypt's decline must be sought in that. Yet it is impossible to resist the feeling that the end of the new kingdom exposes weaknesses present from the beginning. The creativity of Egyptian civilization seemed in the end strangely to miscarry. Colossal resources of labor were massed under the direction of outstanding civil servants, but only to set up the greatest tombstones the world has ever seen. Craftsmanship of exquisite quality was employed, but to make grave goods. A highly literate elite, utilizing a complex and subtle language and possessing in papyrus a material of unsurpassed convenience, deployed them copiously in text and inscriptions, but left to humanity no great philosophical or religious idea. It is difficult not to sense an ultimate sterility, a nothingness at the heart of this glittering tour de force. Only its sheer staying power remains amazing. It worked for a very, very long time, undergoing at least 2 phases of considerable eclipse, by recovering from them seemingly unchanged. Survival on such a scale is a great material and historic success, but remains obscure is why it should have stopped at survival. In the end, even Egypt's military and economic power made little permanent difference in the world, and her civilization was never successfully spread beyond her borders. Of course, in the early times, all social and cultural change was slow and often imperceptible. Used as we are to change, it is difficult for us to sense the huge inertia possessed by any successful social system with their physical and mental environment in the ancient world. Innovation had far fewer and far more occasional sources than now. The pace of history is rapid in ancient Egypt. If we think of prehistory, it seems glacially slow if we reflect on how little daily life must have been changed between Menes and Thutmose III, a period of more than 1,500 years. Only very slowly could technology or economic force exert such pressures for change as we take for granted today. As for intellectual stimuli, these can hardly be strong in society dedicated to the inculcation of routine and the preparation for death. A very interesting but very difficult to fathom society, that of Egypt. That is it for today, my young friends. Until next time, when we will look at Asia's first civilization. Hope you enjoy it. Glad to have you with me. And until next time, God bless and take care.